Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, March 25th on Iris. I'm your reader, Erin. Our first article on the front page: conflicting arguments emerge in murder trial. Attorneys give statements on the opening day of the first-degree murder trial of Deontay W.B. Ellison by Kaylee Reese. There is no argument over who fatally shot a man on a busy Dubuque street last July 2. However, while prosecutors call the killing a murder, a defense attorney says it was the act of a man defending himself. The conflicting arguments took center stage Wednesday on the opening day of the first-degree murder trial of Deontay W.B. Ellison, 26, at the Dubuque County Courthouse. Ellison fatally shot Curtis R. Smothers, Jr., 25, on July 2nd on Loris Boulevard. Quote, "The evidence in this case is absolutely overwhelming," end quote, said County Attorney C.J. May III in his opening statement to jurors. Quote, "The trial of evidence leads to only one place, and that's that Mr. Smothers murderer sits across the courtroom from you today," end quote. Meanwhile, defense attorney Ben Bartles said in his opening statement that no one is disputing that Ellison shot Smothers, but the act was done in self-defense. Smothers was the one who provoked the fight on July 2nd, Bartles said, and Ellison only fired the gun when he couldn't escape Smothers' advances. Bartles added that Smothers told Ellison, quote, "I'm going to kill you," end quote, during the fight. On Wednesday, May played traffic camera footage that captured the shooting in the 400 block of Loris Boulevard. The video, which had no sound, showed Smothers exit a vehicle and run toward his 7-year-old daughter, who was coming out of another vehicle. May said the girl is the daughter of Smothers and Vanessa Ellison, who was also present at the scene, as was her husband, Deontay Ellison, and their two children. The footage showed Ellison and Smothers get into an argument and start fighting. May said Ellison showed Smothers a gun in his waistband before shooting at him, though the initial shot missed. Smothers can be seen on camera twisting away. Quote, "We believe," Mr. Smothers said, "What are you going to do? Shoot me? Shoot me in front of my daughter?" End quote, May said. Video footage showed Ellison shoot Smothers before running into a residence at 419 Loris Boulevard. Camera footage shows a majority of the crowd at the scene also went into the residence while Smothers fell to the sidewalk. But Bartles said that prior to the shooting, the Ellisons spent the day running errands. Quote, "Just 20 minutes before this encounter, Deontay gave a friend a ride to the grocery store," Bartles said. "Just 20 minutes before this encounter, Deontay bought lemonade from a kid's lemonade stand. This is not a person planning a murder," end quote. Several of the prosecution's witnesses took the stand Wednesday, including Smothers' acquaintances Wendell Rogers and Jameson Verkukia. Rogers testified that he was driving Smothers in Versucia to a gas station on July 2 when Smothers spotted his daughter. The pair later tried to help Smothers after he was shot, and Rogers would be seen on video footage kneeling by Smothers' body. Quote, "I was trying to make sure he was breathing and everything," Rogers said. "He stopped breathing after a while," end quote. Moments after the shooting, camera footage showed a fleet of police vehicles arrive and set a perimeter around the area. Dubuque Police Department investigator Kurt Rosenthal said officers applied for a search warrant for 419 at Loris Boulevard, as it was believed the shooter and other witnesses were inside. Rosenthal said Deontay Ellison must have fled that area in the few minutes between the shooting and the arrival of police, though that wasn't known until the search warrant was executed hours after the shooting. A broken window was found at 419 at Loris Boulevard, and portions of nearby fences were knocked down. After executing the search warrant, Rosenthal said he met Vanessa Ellison with her three children inside the residence. She started telling him what had occurred. Quote, "She started crying and fell into my arms. I ultimately had to go down to the ground with her," Rosenthal said. "You could almost describe it as hysterical," end quote. Deontay Ellison fled the state and was the subject of a 12-day manhunt that ended with his arrest by members of the U.S. Marshals Service on July 14th at a residence in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Smothers' mother, Siobhan Buckhalter, also took the stand Wednesday. She testified that Smothers was unable to see his daughter once Vanessa Ellison began dating Deontay Ellison. Buckhalter became emotional at several points during her testimony, including when she spoke about receiving the call about her son's death. Quote, "That's always going to be my baby," she said. "The image I have of my son is happy, silly. He's headstrong, prominent. I loved him with all my heart and soul," end quote. The trial is set to resume this morning. A first-degree murder conviction in Iowa carries an automatic sentence of life in prison without parole. Our next front page article, Platteville land sale finalized. The city will sell 21 acres for $21 to a developer for it to build a $20 million manufacturing facility by Bennett Goldstein, Platteville, Wisconsin. City of Platteville leaders this week authorized the sale of almost 21 acres in the city's industrial park to a developer that will construct and lease a facility whose tenant has pledged to employ at least 200 people. The $20 million estimated cost of the planned 342,000 square foot warehousing, light manufacturing, and distribution facility is so high that the city will sell the property, valued at $1.4 million, for a maximally discounted rate of just $1 per acre based on a land price formula that reduces costs for job creation and infrastructure investment. The facility will be leased to Cummins, a multinational engine and power generator manufacturer, but the city's agreement with the developer and landlord, Indianapolis-based Scannell Properties, does not stipulate that new or high-paying jobs must be created in order to obtain the construction-ready property for just $21. The legal paperwork is unusual compared to previous sales in the industrial park in that Cummins is the building's occupant but not the owner. Quote, "Our agreement is with Scannell," end quote, said Platteville Community Development Director Joe Carroll. Quote, "But they are not the ones creating the jobs, so it didn't really make sense to bind them to creating a certain number of jobs when it is their tenant who is going to be doing that," end quote. It is also unclear how many employees at the Platteville facility will be transfers from other Cummins operations, including a nearby manufacturing outfit in Mineral Point. Cummins previously said the company will employ a combination of existing company staff, new hires, and contracted workers, but did not provide specifics. A spokesperson did not respond to requests for comment for this story. Carroll said Cummins has not provided him with additional details, including the expected pay of new hires. Platteville Common Council members expressed confidence that the construction of the facility will clearly result in job creation and unanimously approved a development agreement with Scannell at a meeting this week. The parties will close on the sale by March 31st. Quote, "Whether it's going to be 200 or whether it's going to be 150 or 250, I don't think we're going to know that until they start putting stuff on the inside," end quote. Council President Barb Dowza told the Telegraph Herald, "Jobs aside, the $20 million cost of the project would more than suffice to qualify Scannell for the discounted property rate using the land formula," Carroll said. Construction of the building, located adjacent to Vision Drive and East Side Road, is expected to begin in April and conclude in March 2022. Cummins will commit to leasing the premise from Scannell's for 10 years. As part of the development agreement, Scannell's cannot sell the building to a tax-exempt entity for at least 15 years. Dowes said there is little reason to believe a nonprofit organization would be interested in a building so large. The development agreement also commits the city to constructing an extension to Vision Drive to provide improved truck access to the property. The project has an estimated cost of $2 million to $3 million. With the creation of new jobs, the city could qualify for grants to finance the street improvement. Perhaps one of the greatest challenges facing the parties will be locating a skilled workforce to fill the new jobs. Existing Platteville production and manufacturing companies, such as Skyway, Precision, Hypro Incorporated, and Emmy Roth, already have multiple openings to fill. Ella Kakade, executive director of Platteville Area Industrial Development Corp, said that though the COVID-19 pandemic left many unemployed, it remains a challenge nationwide to find qualified workers. Quote, "There is a misalignment between the job skills and the expectations," she said. There has to be some training," end quote. Kincaid said the Southwest Wisconsin Workforce Development Board is exploring multiple opportunities, such as the Windows to Work program, which is designed to help incarcerated persons secure employment after their release. Southwest Wisconsin Technical College also provides job training. City leaders have another reason to celebrate the development. The new facility will increase the tax base in the tax increment finance district that encompasses the industrial park. Last year, the district was projected to require $1.4 million in support from city coffers over the next 7 years to finance previous land improvements. With the new construction, additional revenue generated by the district is expected to cover outstanding debts. Quote, "We're really so excited about that," end quote, said Nicola Maurer, Platteville Administration Director. Quote, "Any development in a city is exciting, but to have this development come just in the nick of time," end quote. Our last front page article, officials set assessed value increases. The average homeowner in Dubuque will see a 9.8% increase, 7.3% for the county. Average assessed value changes by city: Asbury plus 11.1%, Cascade plus 10.4%, Dubuque plus 9.8%, Dyersville plus 4.9%, Epworth plus 15.1%, Farley minus 0.1%, and Peosta 11.3% by Kaylee Reese. Dubuque County homeowners this week will start receiving notices of the assessed value of their properties for this year, and in nearly all communities, those values are increasing on average. Assessors for the city of Dubuque and Dubuque County reported a strong buy-in market for homes in 2020, prompting them to calculate property valuation changes. Because of those new calculations, homeowners will generally see assessed value increases larger than have been typical in recent years. Homeowners are expected to start receiving their assessed value notices on Friday. For City of Dubuque residents, the average increase in assessed value for residential properties is 9.8%, though some could see increases as high as 16%. Dubuque County residents outside of the city will see an average increase of 7.3%, but some communities will see an increase as high as 15%. The only two communities that saw assessed values decrease on average were Farley and Sherrill, according to numbers provided by Dubuque County Assessor Dave Kubik. Changes in assessed values for individual homes will vary based on multiple factors, including the home's age, condition, and additions. Quote, we're not estimating why buyers and sellers are doing what they're doing, Kubik said. All we're doing is measuring what they're doing in the market, end quote. The increases were needed after both the city of Dubuque and the rest of Dubuque County saw assessed values levels lower than 100% for property sales in 2020. Assessed value levels, or median ratios, are determined by taking a property's assessed value and dividing it by its sale price. Levels below 100% show that homes sold for more than they were assessed. The city of Dubuque's assessed value level based on 2020 sales was 87.4%, and the rest of the county's was 89.7%. State law mandates that assessed value levels must be between 95% and 105% to keep value assessments equal across the state, so local assessors were required to increase area assessed values. Dubuque City Assessor Troy Patzner said that if the local assessors didn't get set assessed value increases themselves, the state would have issued a blanket increase of about 14% to area residents to set the local median ratio around 100%. He says assessed values are reevaluated every odd year, and home sales have been strong since the last reassessment. Sales of homes priced at $80,000 to $250,000 have been particularly strong, he noted. Quote, we had a lot more sales also, Patzner said. We ended up with about 1,024 sales in the city last year. The couple years before that, we were in the low 800 range, so we've seen a lot higher volume. I think that the low interest rates partially had something to do with it. It seems like other jurisdictions that I've spoken with seem to say the same thing, end quote. Patzner said the assessed value increases, which are based on a home's value as of January 1, will be applied to tax bills in September 2022. However, both Patzner and Kubik noted that assessed values increases won't automatically translate into higher tax bills. Per Iowa law, the state's rollback rate, which determines the percentage of a property's value being taxed, ensures that there is only a statewide 3% growth in assessed values when calculating tax bills. Kubik said assessors in Iowa already know the rollback is going to help offset assessed value increases and, therefore, any tax increases when they calculate new values. Quote, based on what I've heard in my discussions, there's going to be a 7 to 8% assessed value increase statewide, he said. There's no scientific fact behind that. That's just an educated guess. If that happens, the rollback will drop into 3%, end quote. Patzner said setting assessments can be difficult because assessors are basing values of all homes on a much lower number of actual sales. County residents who disagree with their valuation increases can have informal discussions with the assessor's office staff in April or file an appeal with the local board of review from April 2nd to April 30th. Patzner said residents' taxes likely won't go up as much as assessed values, with a clearer picture of tax impacts will come into focus after the new rollback factor is set later this year. Quote, overall, the market is pretty strong, and that doesn't exactly mean taxes are going to go up that amount, Patzner said. That isn't going to be the case, end quote. Moving to more Dubuque local news, Anamosa authorities say two inmates killed, two prison staff in escape attempt by Ryan J. Foley, Associated Press, Anamosa, Iowa. The two inmates wielding hammers attacked staff during a failed attempt to escape the state prison in Anamosa, killing a nurse and a correctional officer, kidnapping a third employee, and severely injuring an inmate who intervened, authorities said Wednesday. Those killed in the attack Tuesday at Anamosa State Penitentiary were identified as staff nurse Lorena Schulte, 50, of Cedar Rapids, and Officer Robert McFarland, 46, of Ely. Both had worked at the prison for more than a decade. Both suffered blunt force trauma to the back of the head and died when they were attacked by hammer-wielding inmates Michael Dutcher, 28, and Thomas Woodward, 39, said Iowa Division of Criminal Investigations Agent Richard Ron. Dutcher and Woodward had a plan to escape and gained access to the prison infirmary at about 10:15 a.m. Tuesday under the ruse that they were there to repair equipment, Ron said. They were able to get into a break room where they shattered glass and tried to use a work tool known as a grinder to cut the metal bars and escape. McFarland was in the break room and was attacked with a hammer, Ron said. Schulte was also hit with a hammer when she, like McFarland, tried to stop the escape attempt. Inmate McKinley Robbie was attacked when he went to try to render aid to the injured employees and is hospitalized with serious injuries, Ron said. Another staff member who tried to intervene was grabbed by Dutcher and told she would be next if she didn't cooperate, but she got free when Dutcher ran out of the room, Ron said. Eventually, other staff restrained Dutcher and Woodward. The two had access to the tools through a prison work program, and the prison is investigating whether security protocols were followed. Quote, two public servants were taken from this world by an act that can only be described as pure evil, end quote, said Iowa Department of Corrections Director Beth Skinner at a news conference. AFSCME Council 61 President Danny Homan, whose union represents Iowa prison workers, said their deaths illustrate how thousands of prison staff members put their lives on the line every day when they go to work. Mourners left flowers and balloons outside the prison. The Anamosa prison houses 950 inmates and has medium and maximum security units. It has about 320 staff. As a history of inmates committing violence against staff, including several assaults in the past year, but the deaths were the first of a prison employee killed by an Iowa inmate since at least 1975, Skinner said. Dutcher and Woodward have been charged with first-degree murder and kidnapping, Ron said. Iowa does not have the death penalty, but a conviction of first-degree murder carries a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. Dutcher was serving a 50-year sentence for an armed bank robbery in Holstein, armed robberies of two motels in Sioux City, and an unrelated drug case. Woodward was sentenced to 25 years in prison in 2017 for first-degree robbery and burglary in a 2014 home invasion in Sioux City. Our next article, nearly 52,000 area residents fully vaccinated. Dubuque County has an increase of 18 new virus infections while fully vaccinating an additional 408 residents, Telegraph Herald. The Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and vaccination. Wednesday's developments included there were no new deaths in the Telegraph Herald's 10-county coverage area between 5 p.m. Tuesday and 5 p.m. Wednesday. 18 new cases were reported in Dubuque County. As of 5 p.m. Wednesday, 83,242 residents in the 10-county area have had at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 51,987 area residents have been fully vaccinated against the virus, 17.2% of the area's population. Dubuque County has 17,532 residents who have been fully vaccinated, an increase of 238 from 24 hours earlier. Dubuque County had a 14-day positivity rate of 2.2% as of 5 p.m. Wednesday. Rates for other area counties were Clayton County 1.9%, Delaware County 4.1%, Jackson County 3.8%, and Jones County 3.6%. The state did not provide county-level hospitalization data on Wednesday. The most recent data as of Monday reported 5 Dubuque County residents with COVID-19 were hospitalized, an increase of 1 from Saturday's census. Delaware County had 2 hospitalizations, an increase of 2. Jackson County had 1 hospitalization, an increase of 1. No such residents of Clayton or Jones counties were hospitalized at that time. Delaware County health officials announced Wednesday that they continue to receive only 200 doses of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine each week. With the limited allocation, officials are vaccinating individuals age 65 and older, people in Tier 1 and Tier 2 of Phase 1B, and individuals age 65 and younger with certain medical conditions. Health officials encourage residents to search for other options for the vaccine in surrounding counties, such as the Bremi Drug in Manchester, Hy-Vee, Walgreens, or CVS. Statewide, the number of residents who have tested positive for COVID-19 grew by 757 in the 24-hour span, increasing the state's total to 347,203. 6 new deaths were reported statewide, so the death toll rose to 5,689. As of 5 p.m. Wednesday, 511,174 Iowans had been fully vaccinated, an increase of 6,276 from Tuesday. Statewide, Wisconsin reported 776 additional cases on Wednesday, increasing the state's total to 573,899. There were 10 additional related deaths reported, raising the death toll to 6,597. Wisconsin reported 1,534,154 residents have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, or 26.3% of the state's population, and 893,146 state residents have been fully vaccinated, or 15.3% of the population. Statewide, Illinois reported 1,227,708 COVID-19 cases as of 5 p.m. Wednesday, a 24-hour increase of 2,793 cases. The state reported 20 more related deaths, increasing the death toll to 21,136. Illinois also reported a 1,890,722 residents were fully vaccinated, 14.8% of the state's population. News in brief, police 1 arrested, 2 injured in brawl at Dubuque restaurant. Police said 2 people were injured when a Dubuque restaurant employee assaulted 2 cooks with margarita glasses during a brawl. Alfredo Luna Jr., 30, was arrested at 10:58 p.m. Tuesday at Fiesta Cancun, 2515 Northwest Arterial, on charges of 2 counts of assault with injury. Court documents state that Daniel A. Cedillo, 18, and Domingo B. Cobo, 21, both cooks at the restaurant, were treated at Unity Point Health Finley Hospital for lacerations near their left ears that required stitches and staples. Cedillo and Cobo reported that they were working in the kitchen at Fiesta Cancun at about 9:40 p.m. when Luna, also a restaurant employee, quote, began to bother them over an order which they were preparing, and then attempted to entice them in a mutual fight, end quote, according to documents. During an ensuing altercation, Luna struck both Cedillo and Cobo in, quote, the back of their hands with heads with margarita glasses, causing injury, end quote, documents state. Luna told authorities that he arrived at the restaurant during the evening to, quote, engage in a mutual fight with an employee, but was jumped by additional employees on scene, end quote, documents state. After being arrested, Luna, quote, admitted to throwing a margarita glass at one of the cooks during the disturbance, end quote, documents state. Dubuque Police Department Lieutenant Ted McClemon said it does not appear that charges will be filed against Cedillo or Cobo. Police, the Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Departments reported Marita Dye, 38, no permanent address, was arrested at 12:29 a.m. Wednesday in the 1100 block of Roomberg Avenue on charges of third offense operating while intoxicated, interference with official acts, and assault on persons in certain occupations. Court documents state that Dye assaulted Officer David M. Lois while she was being arrested. Marco A. Aranda, 22, was arrested at 11:12 p.m. Tuesday on a charge of second-degree burglary. Zachary J. Thill, 19, was arrested at 8:27 p.m. Tuesday in the 1600 block of Butterfield Road on charges of possession of methamphetamine, possession of drug paraphernalia, and interference with official acts, as well as warrants charging four counts of probation violation. Alexis E. Edelin, 23, was arrested at 6:01 p.m. Tuesday in the 400 block of West Locust Street on charges of domestic assault and public intoxication. Court documents state that Edelin assaulted Minna Lewis C. Watson. Courtney D. Brandt, 25, of Platteville, Wisconsin, was arrested at 5:08 p.m. Tuesday in the area of Fremont Avenue and Knob Hill Drive on warrants charging third-degree burglary and three counts of failure to appear in court. Eric A. Schultz, 72, reported $1,500 worth of criminal damage done to a residence at about 10:25 a.m. Tuesday. The city of Dubuque reported $500 worth of criminal damage done to the intersection of Main and West 3rd Streets at about 7:50 a.m. Tuesday. Taco Bell, 2040 Locust Street, reported a case of embezzlement resulting in the theft of $524 at about 3:25 p.m. Monday. John D. Mose, 67, reported the theft of a bicycle worth $2,000 between 10 p.m. March 18th and 10 a.m. Friday from his residence. Janet E. Wampler, 86, reported the theft of $3,000 on March 17th from her residence. Letters to the editor, Iowa GOP lawmakers making poor decisions, from James Thiessen, Spyglass Court, Dubuque. I hope others are as concerned as I am with the recent action of our Iowa legislator. Thanks to the Republican majority, they have now made it harder to vote and easier to get a gun. Seriously, do these lawmakers really represent the people of our state? If so, we are headed down a path of destruction. God help us all. And our next letter, opinion page columnist must stick to facts, from Susan Balsamo, Van Buren Street, Dubuque. The letter from Robert Dunn in the March 16th Telegraph Herald was excellent. Consider this another vote to remove opinion contributors who parrot information that isn't accurate, no matter how popular they are. There are plenty of places to go for those seeking conspiracy theories and other dangerous views. For our political cartoon today, we have three characters. We have two women who are standing in the background wearing masks, and we have one man who is sitting in a chair, and he is also wearing a mask. This man is overweight, and he is wearing shorts and a ratty t-shirt, and he is super slumped in this chair. He's slumped down, shoulders are up on his head, he's hanging his head, he looks very upset and sad and just not happy. And the woman in the background says to the other woman, oh, don't mind him, he's just afraid this COVID thing is going to end and he'll have to go out and socialize. Moving to the obituaries, Sandra M. Schlatter, Menominee, Illinois. Sandra M. Schlatter, 73, of Menominee, died on Monday, March 22nd, 2021. There will be no public visitation. A celebration of life will be scheduled for a later date. Miller Funeral Home of East Dubuque is assisting the family. Judy A. Hansen, 77, of Dubuque, died on Wednesday, March 24th, 2021. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, March 22nd. 26 at Hoffman at Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road, where a prayer service will follow at 7 p.m. A massive Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 27th at Holy Ghost Catholic Church in Dubuque. Funeral services, Carrie L. Ehlers Sr., Worthington, Iowa, Celebration of Life, noon to 5 p.m. Saturday, March 27th, Worthington City Hall. Joan O. Fiji, Cuba City, Wisconsin, Visitation at 9 to 10:45 a.m. today, St. Rose of Lima Church, Cuba City, Massive Christian Burial, 11 a.m. today at the church. The Reverend Richard G. Gowell, Gutenberg, Iowa, Visitation at 2 to 8 p.m. Friday, March 26th, Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville, Iowa, and at 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 27th, Holy Trinity Church, Luxembourg, Iowa, Massive Christian Burial, 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Curtis E. Kraus, Pottsville, Iowa, Visitation 4 to 8 p.m. Friday, March 26th, Leonard Guru Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Monona, Iowa, and 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, March 27th, St. John Lutheran Church, Luana, Iowa, services 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Betty A. Lang, Dubuque, Visitation at 4 to 7 p.m. today, Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, services at 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 26th, Sacred Heart Church, Dubuque. Kenneth W. Pohl, Maquita, Iowa, Visitation at 3 to 7 p.m. today, Dawson Funeral Services, Maquita, services at 10:30 a.m. today, Sacred Heart Catholic Church, Maquita. Georgia M. Reek, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, Visitation at 10 a.m. to noon, Saturday, March 27th, Thornburg Grew Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Prairie du Chien. Wanda J. Sefzik, S-E-F-Z-I-K, Dubuque, Visitation at 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Saturday, March 27th, Eaglehoff Siegert Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road, services 11:30 a.m. Saturday at the funeral home. Thomas E. Sheehan, East Dubuque, Illinois, Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, March 26th, Miller Funeral Home, East Dubuque, and 9:30 to 10:15 a.m. Saturday, March 27th, St. Joseph's Church, Sinsinawa, Wisconsin, services at 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the church. Moving to the sports section, college football, American Rivers Conference, long wait finds end, Laura's UD set for special spring season that kicks off Saturday by Danny Miller. When Saturday arrives, 497 days will have passed since the University of Dubuque and Laura's College last played a football game. They have waited long enough and it is finally time to hit the gridiron. Both schools will kick off an unconventional, abbreviated 2021 season on Saturday, and while it may be a shorter season, the city rivals will still square off on April 10th. Here is a capsule look at the 2021 spring season for UD and Laura's. Dubuque Spartans coach Stan Zweifel, 12th season, 68-44, 2019 record, 7-3. Key offensive players, Jacob Keller, Jr., 6'3", quarterback, Savon Roberts, Jr., 5'11", running back, Tiger Geeslin, Sr., 6', running back, Carletti Famuwantanu, Sr., 5'10", tight end, Elliot Pipkin, Sr., 6'2", wide receiver, A.J. Hunter, Sr., 6', wide receiver, Jordan LaBelle, Jr., 6'8", wide receiver, Damon Street, sophomore, 6', 180 pounds, Jacob Beasley, Sr., 6'3", offensive line, Tyson Welch, Jr., 6'2", offensive line, Kia Miran Housey, freshman at 6'5", offensive line, and Javion Caldwell, senior 6'8", offensive line. Key defensive players, Ben Rashid, sophomore at 6'1", defensive end, Anthony Love, senior 6'2", defensive end, Joshua Bauman, senior 6'1", defensive line, Daquan Ramsey, junior 6', defensive line, Danny Petrella, senior 5'11", defensive line, Marshawn Crowder, senior 6'1", linebacker, Adam Stringgrabber, senior 6'1", linebacker, Casey Larson, junior 6'1", linebacker, Josh Strauss, senior 6', defensive back, Dalton Knack, senior 5'11", defensive back, Colton Peterson, sophomore, 6'1" at defensive back, and Tyler Geeman, junior, 6'1" at defensive back. Outlook, the Spartans closed 2019 on a 6-game winning streak and hope to extend that throughout this abbreviated campaign. Dubuque will be very experienced at the wide receiver positions as they return 4 top pass catchers in Pimpkin, Hunter, LaBelle, and Street. They will also be dynamic at running back with Roberts, who saw significant time in 2019, and Grambling State transfer Geeslin, Keller, a Northern Iowa transfer and All-State prep performer out of Aurora, Illinois, gets the starting nod at quarterback after last year's starter Sean Duffy graduated. The Spartans have playmakers and depth at the offensive skill positions, but will be a bit thinner and more inexperienced on the offensive line. UD's defense appears to be stout and stacked. They have a ton of returning starters in depth, as Zweifel thinks it may be one of the best defensive teams he has coached in his tenure. Dean Graber returns from an all-conference season in 2019 as the leader of the defense. Crowder and Larson will join him in to form a talented trio at linebacker. Knack, Strauss, and Peterson are all returning starters in the secondary. They will be joined by Northern Michigan transfer Tyler Geeman to form a shutdown defensive backfield. Love, Petrella, Rashid Ramsey, and Bauman will be leading the charge up front in a deep, experienced defensive front. If UD hopes to carry over the success of 2019, the defense will be a huge factor. Schedule March 27th at Co., 1 p.m., April 3rd, Wartburg, 1 p.m., April 10th at Loras, 1 p.m., April 17th, Luther, 1 p.m. On our next school, Loras Duhawks. Coach Steve Helmanack, 8th season, 22-48, 2019 record, 5-5. Key offensive players: Noah Sigworth, senior, 6'2", quarterback; Elijah Thomas, junior, 5'7", running back; Cabron Cook, junior, 6'4", wide receiver; Ty Bausch, sophomore, 5'8", running back; Drew Blaskovich, senior, 6'2", offensive line. Key defensive players: Josh Jones, junior, 6'1", linebacker; Josh Kiefer, junior, 6'3", linebacker; Chance Helfill, senior, 6', defensive line; Sam Jones, senior, 6'1", defensive line; Jack Foley, senior, 6', defensive back; Zacharias Knighton, sophomore, 5'9", defensive back; Brett Bauer, sophomore, 6'2", defensive back; Zach Kemp, junior, 5'11", defensive back; and Mason Morris, junior, 5'8", defensive back. Outlook: after 2 straight 4-6 seasons, the Duhawks improved to 5-5 in the 2019 and looked to notch a winning record in the shortened campaign. They will be captained by senior quarterback and Dubuque Walhurt grad Siegworth, who led the team with 10 rushing touchdowns and 8 passing scores last year. They will also get a big boost at running back, as Thomas, who had a breakout freshman season but missed all but 1 game last year due to injury, returns at full strength. Cassville, Wisconsin native Bausch will also be a factor in the backfield, as he rushed for 6 touchdowns in 2019. The Duhawks also will look for increased production from West Delaware grad Cook at wide receiver. His 6'4" frame should be an enticing target for Sigworth this season, and he should be more polished as a junior. The Duhawk defense will be somewhat inexperienced, having lost quite a bit to graduation. Josh Jones and Kiefer both saw time in 2019 and will step in as linebackers. Halef Hill and Sam Jones also saw significant playing time and will be looked to lead the defensive line. The secondary will be led by Foley, who is coming off a stellar 2019 season. The senior from Rockford, Illinois, recorded 22 tackles and 4 interceptions last year. Schedule March 27th at Northwestern, Minnesota, 6 p.m. April 3rd at Luther, noon. April 10th, Dubuque, 1 p.m. April 17th, Wartburg, 1 p.m. April 24th at Co., 1 p.m. Our next article, Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week, Peyton Bauer, Galena. Perseverance pays for Bauer. Galena running back excited to be on field. Telegraph Athlete of the Week, Nominations are accepted Wednesday through Sunday. Three finalists are selected. Voting takes place from Monday at 12:01 a.m. through 5 p.m. Tuesday. Sponsor, Turpin Dodge Chrysler Jeep Ram by Shannon Mum. Peyton Bowers' football career has been anything but a smooth ride. The Galena senior was burdened by injuries in his sophomore and junior seasons and had the coronavirus nearly take away his senior season. Illinois has just kicked off a six-week spring season, and a healthy Bauer is ready to leave his mark. The Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week rushed 23 times for 137 yards and two touchdowns as the Pirates opened with a convincing 28-6 victory over Eastland Pearl City. He also led the team in tackles with 16. Quote, Peyton has worked extremely hard through a lot of unknowns and has taken it upon himself to improve as a player, and quote, Galena head coach Ed Freed said, quote, he is making the most out of the opportunity given to him with this spring season, end quote. Bauer is a three-year starter for the Pirates, starting as a sophomore before suffering a broken hand. During his junior season, he tore the AC joint in his shoulder and was forced to miss four games. Quote, the injuries were extremely devastating for me, Bauer said. Football has been a big part of my life, and it's something I always am looking forward to. To have it taken away from me the past 2 years and then not know if we were going to get a senior season was really heartbreaking, end quote. Bauer has grown up around the game of football, following in the footsteps of older brothers CJ and Dalton, who went on to play football at Loras College. Quote, we grew up playing catch with our dad in the backyard, and he would teach us about the game, Peyton said. We all developed a love for football, end quote. Bauer also has a younger brother, Kian, who is playing for the Pirates. Quote, when I was younger, I always looked up to my brothers, Peyton said. Every time I got to watch them, I took so much away from it. I got to play with CJ, and now I have the chance to play Kian. Being there for him means so much to me because I know how much it meant to me to have my older brothers to look up to, end quote. When Bauer found out Galena was going to get a spring season, he was extremely thankful. Quote, finally being healthy and then not getting a season in the fall was just a terrible feeling as a senior, he said. There was a time when we thought that it was it and we just weren't going to get to play at all. So when we heard we were going to get a spring season, I was just so grateful. I can't even describe how good it felt to play on a Saturday. It's something I never felt before, end quote. Added Freed, quote, we are so excited that the kids are getting a chance to play, especially the seniors. Peyton comes from a talented football family, and we've had a Bauer starting at running back since 2015. It's great to have him back and healthy for his final season. He's a great leader and has earned the utmost respect from his coaches and teammates, end quote. Moving back to the opinion page, Other View, Renewal Comes Forth with Spring by Eric Frydulund for the Telegraph Herald. Spring has officially arrived, marked on our own calendar like the birthday of an old friend. We come to the birthday party in a festive mood, having swapped out our winter coats for sweatshirts and traded our winter boots for hiking shoes. We've traveled a long road to get here. A little more than a month ago, we were traveling through snow. More than a foot fell over a couple of days and slowed life down to a pace befitting a holiday from the busy world. I donned my snowshoes, which looked more like pontoons floating my weight and height, to explore the lodging road winding up the hill on the other side of the dry wash. I labored through the deep snow methodically, less like a pontoon than a fully laden grain barge lumbering up the river. Branches embroidered with snow created a low slung cathedral suited for winter worship. The branches bowed gracefully toward the altar. I heard a loud crack above my head and looked up to see a large tree limb fall to the ground about 15 yards away. I figured it was time to end my reverence and get the heck out of there. After the snow, the cold hit hard. Long johns became a permanent part of my wardrobe. Walking out at the park in 0-degree temperatures became a fool's errand, and I seemed qualified for the task. Even zipping my jacket over my head did not help stem the cold. The chill penetrated like a cold bath, but the icicled trees frozen in time made up for the half hour it took to put on 20 layers of clothes. Two deer cut across our paths on the way back to the parking lot. Oblivious to the elements, they leaped gracefully through the snow, shaming our own self-indulgent complaints. Our dog, Fargo, gave chase, but within 50 yards, he realized it was a hopeless cause. Humility comes quickly to Fargo in deep snow, as it does to the rest of us. In March, warm days began to beat back the snow. Hillsides marked the progress of seasons. South-facing slopes shed their winter clothing first, their white cloaks laying lain in a heap at the bottoms of the hills, the north-facing slopes to tell the sun to come back another day, and of course it does. Despite that date on our calendar, spring comes close slowly. The land emerges from winter hibernation like an extremity recovers from frostbite. A warm wind comes and we can move our little finger again. A warm day comes and we can throw a baseball once more. Winter teaches us to be patient. For spring, for a warm fire, for the next step, for renewal. Doug Peacock, author of Grizzly Years, writes of spring's renewal. Quote, scholars believe that bears provided the original model of renewal. The bear showed early man how to get through the little death of winter by burial, emerging from the cold in spring, sometimes with new life in the form of bear cubs. The bear showed the way of survival and renewal as part of the cycle of life. End quote. With the nature as our guide, we look forward to spring's renewal. In the year of the pandemic, we yearn for a new beginning, and not just to welcome back old routines, but to embrace change. In the greening of spring, nature performs its annual ritual of budding, but it also grows anew, reaching for the sun. There's a part of my walk overlooking Highway 18 that brings visitors and commerce to and from points east. The high-pitched sound of rubber singing on concrete coincides with the bustle of spring among people, but the woods call me back to its magical quiet. I'm not sure when and where you are sitting as you read this, but I am writing this as I sit on my stump in the woods overlooking a valley drenched in sun. Quote, man, what a beautiful day, end quote, I say aloud to myself. It's the only thing I've said all day that makes perfect sense. Again, that opinion came from Fryden Lund, a columnist who lives in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, writes about nature, politics, and social issues from a systems perspective. And our last opinion, other view, peace negotiations in Afghanistan moving forward by Arthur Syar for the Telegraph Herald. Serious, sensitive, tangled negotiations aimed at bringing peace to Afghanistan have now reached and surpassed the 6-month mark. Many knowledgeable people are surprised, in some cases amazed, that these talks have taken place at all. Representatives of the government of Afghanistan and the Taliban movement continue their direct peace negotiations in Doha, capital of the Persian Gulf states of Qatar. The two sides held their first meeting on September 12th. An Al-Qaeda Islamic terrorist group based in Afghanistan planned and carried out the horrific, murderous attacks on the United States on September 11th, 2001. Hijacked civilian aircraft became large lethal missiles. High-octane aviation fuel provided massive explosions on impact as well as propellant. Planes struck the World Trade Center in New York City and the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. Another went down in the Pennsylvania countryside. The last likely was to hit the U.S. Capitol or White House. Passenger heroes prevented that. In response, military forces of a comprehensive international coalition of nations led by the U.S. overthrew the fundamentalist Taliban regime in Kabul. Both the United Nations and NATO have implemented this effort, which has steadily developed increasingly large-scale economic modernization and political reform dimensions along with the military. In February 2020, after nearly 2 decades of occupation, the U.S. government and the fundamentalist Taliban movement signed a formal agreement for the phased withdrawal of international troops. The accord includes detailed stipulations to help protect the population and discourage the return of terrorists. This struggle to find a reasonably responsible, acceptable diplomatic route for departure reflects a subtle and sustained sentiment among Americans. Donald Trump's 2016 election victory reflects this sentiment involving strong support among our rank and file military. Context is important. Afghanistan has no established history of formal representative elections, Western-style rule of law, or a reliable national government. Local tribal leaders remain powerful, dominant politically and socially, lethal in armed conflict. The Soviet Union, after years of de facto control over the national government, in 1979 took over directly through the nation's massive military invasion and occupation in Afghanistan. A decade of unconventional warfare followed before Moscow finally faced reality and withdrew. President Jimmy Carter, to his great credit, provided aggressive, effective leadership in supplying American weapons and related support for the Mujahideen warriors who fought the Russian military. President Ronald Reagan expanded aid to include light, relatively inexpensive Stinger anti-aircraft missiles. Over time, Afghanistan became a continuing nightmare quagmire. The steady killing of mostly young men in the Red Army led to popular opposition, expressed even in the totalitarian Soviet Union. The frustrating nature of the South Asia struggle can mask such positive changes as reasonably honest elections and growing participation of women. Despite lack of infrastructure, technology spreads steadily. Cell phones and the internet, as well as traditional television, are now features of isolated communities. Afghanistan remains important for the U.S. in a manner broadly similar to the priority Great Britain attached to South Asia traditionally. Major east-west trade routes traverse the region today, as in ancient times. Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, released from Britain in 1966, contains a major American military base. B-52 bombers based there supported the Allied military invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks. The U.S. and allies were right to overthrow the Taliban in Afghanistan and are now right to withdraw. In future, disciplined collective effort should guide Washington policy. The Afghan people are responsible for their nation. That is also right. Again, that opinion came from Arthur Sire, who is a Clausen Distinguished Professor at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Tri-State Section, Throwback Thursday. City takes look at rehabilitation of historic Dubuque landmark in 2001 by Eric Hogstrom. A 120-foot tall Dubuque landmark had fallen into despair 20 years ago, prompting officials to consider rehabilitation efforts. Constructed in 1856, the Shot Tower attracted increased attention from local officials in 2001 because of plans to construct the Mississippi River Walk in the Port of Dubuque. The River Walk was completed in June of 2003. Dubuque officials eventually leveraged a $295,000 Save America's Treasures grant from the National Park Service and a $100,000 Historic Sites Preservation grant from the State Historical Society of Iowa to help rehabilitate the tower. Here is how the Telegraph Herald reported on the Shot Tower in its March 29, 2001 edition. City takes shot at sprucing up one of its landmarks. A local landmark that has survived a fire and a train collision could soon receive help weathering time. Laura Karstens of the Planning Services Department said the city and the old house enthusiasts want to enhance the 145-year-old Shot Tower and its surroundings. They expect the Riverwalk planned to stretch from Dove Harbor to the Ice Harbor to increase the volume of people near the Shot Tower. On Monday night, the old house enthusiasts will give the city council $1,000 for a feasibility study on the Shot Tower. The city will provide the rest of the money to look into sprucing up the tower, which is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The Shot Tower was built in 1856 to produce lead shot. For 3 years, molten lead was poured from the top of the tower through sieves. The lead formed into balls while falling to solidify in cool water. The tower did not make shot for the Civil War, but it is historically significant. Standard Lumber Co. used the tower for watching over its riverside land and logs from early 1880s until a fire destroyed the tower's wooden framework in 1911. More than 40 years later, Dubuque citizens raised nearly $12,000 to repair the Shot Tower. It stood empty and unharmed at the end of the 4th Street until a Chicago Central and Pacific Railroad grain car knocked a hole in it in 1991. Our next article, Council Approves Budget, by John Cruz. Dubuque City Council members passed a budget Wednesday that will result in no increases to the city portion of homeowners' property tax bills. The amended fiscal year 2022 budget, which was passed by council in a 7-0 vote, will reduce the city property tax rate by 2.51%. That means the city portion of the property owner's tax bill will remain unchanged for residential properties after accounting for the state's rollback factor, which determines the percentage of a property's value being taxed. Commercial, industrial, and multi-residential properties will see a decrease to the city portion of their property taxes. Council members previously voted to set the maximum property tax rate for fiscal year 2022 at $10.05 per $1,000 of assessed value. That would have resulted in a city property tax increase of $12.49 for the average residential property owner. However, City Manager Mike Van Milligan said funding from the Federal American Rescue Plan Act will allow the city to reduce its property tax rate to $9.889 per $1,000 of assessed value. Van Milligan said the city is projected to receive $27.4 million through the federal COVID-19 relief package. The city can lower its property tax rate using $425,000 of those funds for equipment replacements instead of using property tax money. The rest of the federal funds will be used for capital projects, assistance programs, and maintenance. The budget for the fiscal year starting July 1 still comes with increases to water, sanitary, sewer, stormwater, and solid waste rates, which will result in the average user in Dubuque paying $39 more for the year. Van Milligan said federal relief funding will allow the city to avoid budget cuts and layoffs, remove a hiring freeze on several vacant positions, and fund equipment purchases and maintenance projects. Councilmember Brad Kavanaugh commended the budget, but questioned why officials did not devote more federal relief dollars to fund city improvement packages. Quote, it appears that you chose to apply all those savings to lowering the property tax rate rather than funding some of those improvement packages that we were not originally able to fund, end quote, he said. Van Milligan said city officials are focusing on using the money for projects that will not come with reoccurring costs to subsequent years, which would require the city to increase taxes to pay for them. Quote, we would basically be digging a hole for future budgets, end quote, he said. Council member David Resnick praised the budget, saying the city is accomplishing a lot while maintaining a relatively low tax rate for a city of its size. Quote, they've done all that and included funding for a more inclusive city, he said. That's a really tall order this year, and they pulled it off, end quote. Council member Laura Roussel said she believes the budget points the city in a positive direction. Quote, I think overall this budget will allow our community to grow and prosper, she said. This budget will still provide the services that our residents and businesses expect, end quote. Our next article, Warren Home, a total loss following explosion, no injuries reported. Warren, Illinois. A Warren home is considered a total loss following an explosion and fire Wednesday afternoon. No injuries were reported. Emergency responders were called at 12:38 p.m. to a house on Pearl Street after an explosion was reported, Warren Fire Chief Jeff Edge said. They arrived to find the house on fire and, quote, smoke coming out from all directions, end quote, he said. Firefighters were unable to enter the building because the roof had collapsed, so they fought the blaze from outside the structure. Firefighters spent about an hour getting the fire under control and were on the scene for about 5 hours, Edge said. No one was in the house at the time of the explosion. Edge said the structure is considered a total loss, noting that one wall also collapsed. He said the cause of the blaze is still under investigation. The evidence so far is, quote, pointing toward, end quote, a gas explosion, but officials do not know for sure. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, March 25th on Iris. I'm your reader, Erin. I am so sorry if I pronounce anybody's names incorrect this reading also. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.